You're listening to a sermon preached at Sojourn Church North. In Ecclesiastes, we discover that a life spent in pursuit of pleasure, achievement, and control will ultimately leave us empty-handed. Life isn't about what we can obtain, but about what we already have, and learning to receive it from God with gratitude. Welcome to Ecclesiastes, Life as Gift, Not Gain.
Good morning, everybody. Peace be with you. My name is Chad Lewis, and I'm a pastor here. And if you're visiting with us, we're so thankful that you're here, and we'd love to give you more information about the church. Next Sunday, after the service, we're going to have another pizza fellowship like we did a month ago that was very well attended. It was a lot of fun. There was a spontaneous kickball game that took place. I thought about joining in, but then I thought better with my hamstrings that might be too devastating. That was a little joke, but I could stretch out. But we're going to do that again. If the weather doesn't allow it, we can move it inside and we'll just have it in here. We'll have some gluten-free options, drinks, and some other things. But really, the goal of those is just to get to know each other better. We'll throw on some name tags and just hopefully meet some people that we don't know yet. And that's our desire to keep on moving that forward. Well, we're in our third week of a 12-week series through Ecclesiastes. We're going to be talking about work today. And so as I was reflecting and praying this week, I thought about if we all could take a moment and just say, what is my dream job? How would you answer that? What is my dream job? Some of you may have your dream job. A lot of people don't. I think throughout the history of the world, most people don't. And I think if you think about that dream job, if you had it, it would be exciting. It might be fulfilling for a while. But what we see in a fallen world is that it cannot fill you up forever. There's thorns and thistles everywhere. There's things about even the best job that you don't like. I struggle with email because I've been at Sojourn for 17 years and had the same email address for 14 years as a pastor. And I get emails all the time. And just weeding through those, sometimes I'm afraid to even open it up because it sparks me with anxiety. But I have to weed through those and just like, okay, let's do this. But all of us have parts of our jobs that we don't really care for. And I was thinking about the previous generation. I love talking to people who are older and who've experienced life in different ways than we experience it these days. And I thought about a lot of people in the previous generation and the generation before that had the same job for 30, 40 years, same place, same assembly line, whatever it may be. Then they retired, got the gold watch. And if you'd went up to them and said, hey, was your job amazing? Did it fulfill you completely? Were you happy? And they'd go, a lot of them would go, what are you talking about? It was my job. I went to work. It was my job. It paid the bills. Today, I feel like we often promote this fallacy to young people. And I'm going to try to nuance well enough so no one gets bummed out too bad today. But we can promote the fallacy to say, hey, if you study hard enough and get the right career, you will be happy. You will be completely happy. There's some aspects to that, having a calling from God, to whether it's being an engineer, stay-at-home mom, whatever it may be, that can bring some fulfillment, but it cannot bring ultimate fulfillment. We all have work within a day's time, within a week's time. Some of you build walls, some of you serve coffee, some of you fly airplanes, some of you stay at home with kids, laundry, cooking. There's all sorts of things that we do. And it can become drudgery. The list can go on and on. And so this week, as we look at the teacher, we all remember there's two people speaking in Ecclesiastes. The first verse is the author, and then the last section is the author in chapter 12, and in between is the teacher or the preacher, just sharing his experience under the sun. And the way I'd like to say it is life in a fallen world. And so he's going to give his philosophy on work today, and we're going to seek to apply that to our lives. So if you're able, I'd invite you to stand for the reading of God's word. Ecclesiastes 2, we'll be looking at 18 through 26. This is what the teacher says. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned my heart So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over the toil of all my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are filled with sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. This is the word of the Lord. And you may be seated. So I have 2 points today. The first one is experiencing work in a fallen world. Experiencing work in a fallen world. And the other one is redeeming work in a fallen world. So let's look at experiencing work in a fallen world. And we just read it. But let's look at verse 18 again, because it's pretty powerful. How did the teacher experience work in a fallen world? This reminds me of Debbie Downer right here. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun. I hate it, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. So there's some intensity right here. And so this led me to the question this week, and it's a question we've answered many times, but we keep on going back. Is work inherently bad? Is work inherently bad? And we have to go back to the very beginning to answer that question, before the fall. Because in Genesis 1, 28, this is what it says, and God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on earth. And then in Genesis 2:15, it says, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. So work is a gift from God. Work has been given to us by pre-fall, when everything was great, everything was perfect. Work was a blessing that God gave to humanity. But then, you know what happens? Genesis 3, it wasn't enough for Adam and Eve. They're deceived. They eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and sin comes into the world. And we say it a lot like this, that sin doesn't create anything new. Sin is a parasite. It latches onto that which is good, that which God has created, and it perverts it or turns it into something it was never meant to be, making it an idol, whatever else. And so if sin's a parasite, sin has attached to everything in our world, and it also has complicated work. We see that God pronounces curses, hardships on humanity. And I want to stress even here that we can think about the curses as God just being angry and just punishing Adam and Eve and humanity. But I want you to even think about Hebrews, that what it says is God disciplines us with the heart of a father, not to punish, but to yield righteousness. And think about the curse, thorns and thistles with work. Work's going to be frustrated, Adam. And then to Eve, he said, there's going to be pain in childbirth. You're going to have struggles with your husband. Struggles in the family. And I would say to this, that this is a grace of God, that he allows in the fallen world, that he won't let you be filled up completely with work. It will never be enough. God in his grace says, I will never let family be enough. Brokenness has entered all these places. And the reason I say it's a grace, even though it is a hard thing to swallow, is that anything that continues to put our eyes to God to say, hey, I need more. Even in a few weeks, what we'll talk about is eternity has been placed in our hearts by God. We long for more. We have souls that are the size of Grand Canyons. Work cannot fill us up. Family cannot fill us up. And so if we put undue pressure on work to do something it can't do, we're going to be miserable. And like we said last week, we can either blame others or blame ourselves. But if we can put it in its right place, it can be received as a gift from God. So the teacher in Ecclesiastes, he's saying, I hated this. It was toil. It's vexation. It says, even in the night, my heart does not rest. This also is vanity. And remember, vanity, meaningless, whatever your translation says. It's that hevel. It's that smoke from a candle or vapor or trying to grab it. It's a paradox. And last week, we looked at laughter, alcohol, work, nature and money, possessions, music, relationships, sex, affirmation. We looked at all those things, and the teacher saying, like, these things can't fill us up. And I want to continue to be reminded of that, because there's something that we have, and I know it's with me. I got intellect, and I know so much. But there's a double knowledge that goes on, and we can call it explicit knowledge in our heads, implicit knowledge in our bodies. And we, by default, go towards things. And it's like, I know pigging out on a huge meal is not going to, it's going to be pleasurable for a while, and it may numb me. But I know it's not going to fill me up, but I'm drawn to it. You can fill in the blank with whatever you have. I know if I do this, this, and this, I know it's not good, but my body moves towards it. And we can put work in a place like that to think, if I can achieve, if I can get the next raise, if I can get the next promotion, whatever it may be, if, then I'll be happy. But when we get it, the shine wears off. And I was thinking about the second law of thermodynamics this week with entropy. Everything moves from a state of order to chaos or disorder. Things only move from chaos or disorder to order with a force being pushed upon it. And I love the show. One of my favorite shows of all times is American Pickers. Anybody ever watch that show? It's guys who go, I love old stuff. I think my dad instilled that on me. I call it, it's my treasure. It's other people's junk. I gathered way too much in my life and have had to weed through it a few times. But even in my garage now, I have this section that's just old stuff. It doesn't matter what it is. If it's old, I'll take it. But I really won't. I have to use wisdom for the sake of my marriage. So, but I think it's fascinating. Like, they go into these barns and these homes where they have all these antiques, and they're looking through, and so usually it's a dude or a woman who's like 70 or 80, and they're saying, we have to sell this stuff off. And they say, well, why did you decide now to get rid of this stuff? And they say, my children have no interest in it. They don't want it. And I'm like, man, I'll be your kid. I'll come and take it. But it's interesting, even in this, like, they were so excited and passionate about collecting pinball machines or whatever it may be, player pianos. The list goes on and on. But at the end of the day, they sit with disappointment. They say, yeah, my kids just don't like this stuff. It was my passion, and I wish I could have passed it on. It's hevel. It's hevel. And so what I want to hit us with are a few myths with working in a fallen world. And so three different quick myths, and see if one of these sticks with you. And remember, once again, I'm not just talking about what we understand right here, but what we're drawn to in our souls, okay? So myth number one, your work will change the world and have a lasting impact. Myth number one, your work will change the world and have lasting impact. Ecclesiastes 1:11 says this, we don't remember what happened in the past, and in future generations, no one will remember what we're doing now. I'm going to take a sidestep here and nuance for a second. Can God use somebody to do amazing things? Absolutely. I think about Amy Carmichael, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Oswald Chambers, John Newton. Go down the list. But typically, God uses them to impact the world after they're dead. He does some in their life, but he inspires millions after, and that's his choice, right? So I want to nuance, but if we put pressure on work that we're going to change the world, it's going to end pretty bad for us. Anybody notice that the world keeps getting crazier and crazier? Man, I feel like we stepped into bizarro world. It's crazy out there. But we're called to be faithful. I may not be called to change the world, but God's grace can allow someone's world to be changed by me, by you. But don't put that pressure on work. Myth two, work brings ultimate joy, satisfaction, and fulfillment. That's a myth. Some people are more fulfilled and joyful in their jobs. I know some people, a few people who are like, man, I love my job. I can't wait to get to work. But there's still thorns and thistles in that work. And a lot of people, it's drudgery. It's like, man, I go to work, and I go to work, and then I go to work, and I go to work. Ecclesiastes 2:20 says, so I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toils of my labors under the sun. If you put work in a place where you say, work, you have to fulfill me, it's going to go sideways. It always does. Myth 3, your work is your identity and will make you important. Your work is your identity and will make you important. We know that's a myth. It's interesting, a lot of times when we meet people, it's like, hey, what do you do? And I've been pastoring for a while. I've been over the country to church planning, retreats and other pastor seminars. And it's interesting, even with pastors, they come up and it's like, hey, where do you pastor? Oh, what's your role? Oh, okay. How many people you got? How big's your building? What's your budget? And it's like, it feels pretty sick, but it's kind of like you see the insecurity of like, hey, I got to get propped up. And it's like, could I go and just say, hey, I pastor church about 100 people. We're blowing and going. Love it. At times. Other times I don't. I try not to let you know when I don't. I just keep smiling, but my work can't be my identity. And I teach in formation, our ultimate identity is that we're beloved children of God. Everything flows from that. We're human beings, we're not human doings. If I can have my ultimate identity, and it's so hard, this is where I've known it for years and years right here, but it continues to sink in a little deeper each year. My ultimate identity is I'm a beloved child of God. I can leave the outcomes to God. I'm just called to be faithful. I'm just called to be faithful in my work, plowing my little section of land. So what about redeeming work in a fallen world? Redeeming work in a fallen world. How do we do that? And it's even as James quoted at the beginning here, as we try to settle our minds, it takes a lot of remembering and a lot of renewing of our minds. A lot of remembering and a lot of renewing of our minds. And when we get off the path, we seek to hear from our friends or we seek to hear from the Lord like, hey, you've stepped over here. And a lot of times the grace of dissatisfaction or just being miserable is a sign like, hey, something's a little off right now. It doesn't have to mean that. It can just mean that you're suffering. But it can mean like, hey, I'm just so angry right now. There's something bubbling up. But how do we redeem work? And the teacher says it in Ecclesiastes 24 and 25. I decided there's nothing better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in work. Then I realized that these pleasures are from the hand of God, for who can eat or enjoy anything apart from him? So we see these things are a gift. And I think this gets to even the philosophy of being mindful about our moment. You know, you've heard before, like, I can't even remember. I think it was a Charlie Brown cartoon, but it was like something about the present as a gift. I'll just leave it at that. I can't remember. Past, present, future. I was meeting with a friend right out here on Friday, a member of the church, and we were just sitting talking about how hard the last year's been, talking about depression, about physical struggles, all sorts of stuff. And we just talked and talked and talked. And I said at one point, I've become more convinced of this. And it's in some ways, it's a bitter pill to swallow. But in this fallen world, life under the sun, that the hardships we're given, there can be a gift in each of them. If those things can turn my face to God, and the greatest need we have is to be dependent on God, the greatest growth in our life is that we would trust him more. Augustine said the sin in the garden that we talked about was hubris or pride. That was the first sin. But Calvin later came and said that wasn't the first sin. The first sin was mistrust. And for the rest of our lives, we're trying to grow in trust of who God is, that he's good, that he loves us, that he's going to bring us home. So these hardships can grow us. And so I want to hit you with three quick reminders So I hit three myths. These are three reminders how to redeem. Not an all-inclusive list, but these were important to me as I studied this week, and they resonated with my heart. Remember, simplicity can be enough. Remember, simplicity can be enough. Reminder number one. In the Thessalonian church, Paul writes, "But we urge you to do this more and more, and to aspire to live quietly, to mind your own affairs, and to work with your hands as we instructed you, so that you may walk properly before outsiders and be dependent on no one." If you study in Thessalonians, Paul's saying, because a lot of them were just waiting for Jesus to return. They're sitting on the roofs waiting for the rapture to take place. And he's like, no, keep working. Live quiet lives. Be faithful. And I think this is a description of what's going on in the church of Thessalonica. And I think there are times where we need to have movements and all sorts of things. But my question to me and to you this week, is it enough if God calls you to live a simple life? Is it? It just seems so interesting in our culture these days that we get caught up. I get caught up in it too. It's like, you got to do things bigger. You got to do things greater. Here we go. It's got to be large, famous, and fast. Let's go. So as Zach S. Wine says, it's a critique of the culture of church too. Large, famous, fast. Let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go. And he says the church and growth, it's slow. It's doing mostly things that are unnoticed over a long period of time. That's what growth comes from. Is simplicity enough for us if God calls us to that? I have a friend who's a pastor, dear friend. He was getting counsel from who we call the pastor of pastors, Rich Plass from Crosspoint Ministry. And so my friend was talking about all these opportunities. He was so busy and he was getting stressed with all the things going on in life. And so Rich sat him down and subversively started asking him questions. He said, so tell me how many people are coming to your church. And my friend said, 800. And he said, tell me how many people you have in your family. He already knew this, but he's just subversively asking. He says, well, I got five kids. They're between these ages. They're pretty young. And Rich stopped right there because my friend was about to say, yeah, but I'm getting these opportunities to speak out in these different places and maybe some book opportunities. And Rich stopped after just saying he's a pastor and he's a father and a husband. And Rich just looked at him and said, is this not enough? Is this not enough? In this season of life, who knows what the next seasons will hold, but is it not enough just to pastor and love on your family? And my friend took that counsel, and I tell you what, he's a lot more at peace now because of that. Simplicity. Reminder two, do your work with Jesus. Do your work with Jesus. I have great compassion on those who feel like you're in a dead-end job, and days turn into months, turn into years, and you just feel trapped. I felt like that for several years school teaching. It was interesting because when I graduated from college, I got a job school teaching and coaching at a big, big private school in Memphis, Tennessee. It's where the player Michael Orr from Blindside, the movie with Sandra Bullock, he went there. It was called Briarcrest Christian School. They changed the name for the movie. But I did some coaching with Hugh Freeze, who went on to coach at Ole Miss and is at Liberty now. It was like I was so excited to get there, 23-year-old. My first day of teaching, I left. And I was like, this is the worst job ever. This is horrible. And I wanted to quit immediately, but I was like, I signed a year contract. And so I coached. I taught six sections of Algebra 2 in a row, the same class six times in a row every day. Then in seventh period, I ran to get ready for track practice or cross country or basketball. Man, and I did that for a few years. And I thought, maybe it'll get better. Maybe it'll get better. And it's like, it's not getting better. Maybe it's time to move on. But if you're stuck in something, it can be even hard to get out of bed. But I would tell you this. If you feel like you're in a drudgery of a job, Jesus knows drudgery. I was even thinking this week, Jesus learned and then he apprenticed to be a carpenter. Didn't start his public ministry till he's 30. Jesus knows the table that he's going to make right now. I'm just holy imagination. It's not going to be around in a few centuries, but he still makes it. Cabinets, whatever it may be. it was worthwhile. Jesus knows. And we quote this verse a lot, but we have to keep coming back to it. Matthew 11, 28 to 30. Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden. You carry heavy burdens. Come to me and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am humble and gentle in heart." And what's the key here? You will find rest for your souls. The result. "For my yoke is easy to bear and the burden I give you is light." And there have been many times, I even set up a chair sometimes in my office and imagine Jesus. So Jesus said, "He'll never leave us or forsake us. He's always with us." But I know my tendency is I can do work all the time like an orphan. Like I'm alone, it's all up to me. And there's nothing that beats me down quicker than that. It's like boom, boom, boom. But if I can imagine and know that Jesus is with me, he'll never leave us or forsake us. And even sitting with me in my office, even helping me with my emails, said, "Lord, teach me how to love today. Teach me how to do this today with you in the misery of my job, if that's where you are. In the difficulty of raising small kids at home that are going nuts and you don't have energy. And the house is wrecked. Lord, be with me. Help me acknowledge you're with me." Reminder three, final reminder. Remember, God sees and uses your labor. 1 Corinthians 15:58. "Therefore, my brothers and sisters, stand firm. Let nothing move you. Always give yourselves fully to the work of the Lord." And why? Why? What's our motivation? "Because you know that your labor in the Lord is not in vain." It's not in vain. The good things you do that no one sees, the times you kneel in your closet and pray, no one sees it. God sees it. It's not in vain. The kindness and the smile, the hug you give to someone and bring encouragement to them, it is not in vain. The giving to this church financially, even if it feels so small to you, it is not in vain. God sees and he uses all these things. And we're called to persevere. And my final thought was a case study with Moses in Exodus, first 40 years of his life. And it was the reason I thought of him praying this week is like, that dude knew some work. And he knew what it was to be pretty frustrated in work. So the first 40 years of his life, he's in Pharaoh's court, miraculous story. He's learning, believe that God put something in his heart to help his Hebrew brothers and sisters. So he sees one of them being attacked by an Egyptian, strikes him, the Egyptian dies, it's found out, he flees for his life. So everything he prepared for seems to be down the toilet. Then he finds a family, becomes a shepherd, 40 years shepherding. Probably thought that's what it was going to be for the rest of his life. And then the burning bush, and God says, "I'll call you to this." And if you allow me to be sarcastic just for a moment, that's when Moses' life really started and everything was awesome. He got to preach sermons and people were like, "Yeah, Moses, we love you." You know, that's not the story. They grumbled. Moses did great things, but he sinned greatly too. Wasn't even allowed to enter the promised land. But he was a faithful man. Work didn't fill him up, but he went to the end. And listen what he wrote. This is a song he wrote for the Hebrews. It's in the Psalms, Psalm 90. They were to sing this as part of their worship sometimes. Psalm 90, I'll read just a few portions of it. Verse 10, Moses says, "The years of our life are 70, or even by reason of strength, 80. Yet their span is but toil and trouble. They are soon gone and we fly away." Verse 14, it leads into a prayer. "Satisfy us in the morning with your steadfast love, that we may rejoice and be glad all of our days." And at the very end, he has a beautiful prayer. It says, "Lord, let your work be shown to your servants and your glorious power to their children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands." Yes, establish the work of our hands. And so as we come to communion, we know we can rest in these facts to be true. These things are true. That Jesus' work has been completed. It's tetelestai. It means it is finished, paid in full. We call it the finished work of the cross that we celebrate every week, that Christ lived and died and was raised again. He was perfect. He bore the sin that we should bear. And instead of that, he takes it and he gives us his righteousness. And so we celebrate each week with the Lord's Supper to remember his blood and his body were given for us. And so if you're a Christian here today, you're a believer in Christ, in just a moment after I pray, I invite you to come grab one of these. It's got the bread on top in the first tab. Second tab is the juice underneath. We have some gluten-free wafers as well. And you can take it back to your seat and we'll instruct you how to take it after everyone gets one. But to do this and say, Lord, thank you for the finished work of the cross. And whatever he's laying on your heart, dialogue with him about it here this morning. Let's pray together.